So if we have them coming in, so most of the time that we spend is doing the paperwork, because those children that we screen, they have to be they have to be tracked by the school, and they have to let the parents know if the child passed the vision exam, so they could be referred. Again, one of the things that Lions do, not only do we tell them they need to be referred, but we also go a step further by giving them a free follow-up evaluation at a clinic, at a Visions clinic, via the College of Optometry that our club does, my Lions club does that, or to a private practitioner in the area that the Lions club would pick up the cost. So again, the idea is not to just tell a parent that, hey, your child didn't pass the vision exam, but also to tell them what the next step is, because that's very important. How do they move forward and get the child seen and provide them with a pair of glasses if that's what they need? And, you know, so again, that's part of providing a full service as far as screenings are concerned.
On that note, Dr. Freddy Perez, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. Many people don't realize that Jewish Zionism as a plan for international Jewish safety was widely unpopular among most Jews for the first six decades of its existence, from the 1870s to the 1930s. As historian Zachary Foster wrote in his essay, The Forgotten History of Jewish Antisemitism, it didn't become mainstream until the 1940s in conjunction with the annihilation of millions of European Jews. Zionism then flourished for the next six decades, including transforming the religious affiliation of Jewish institutions in the U.S. and around the world from Judaism to Israelism. But as Foster writes, over the past two decades, and especially the past 2 years, world Jewry has split. While Zionism is fully entrenched among Jews in Israel, it has ebbed among Jews here in the U.S., where a full 70% of Jews outside of Israel reside, and where support for Zionism is collapsing at the fastest rate ever. From its origins, most American Jews opposed Zionism until World War II. In fact, the Reform Movement publicly rejected Zionism in an 1898 declaration stating, quote, "The mission of Judaism is spiritual, not political," end quote. After World War I, 299 prominent U.S. Jews wrote an open letter protesting, quote, "the political segregation of the Jews and the reestablishment in Palestine of a distinctly Jewish state," end quote, believing Zionism was opposed to the principles of democracy and a Jewish state in the land of 90% non-Jews was anti-democratic. Even by the mid-1930s, Zionism attracted only a minority of U.S. Jewry. At the time, the major American Zionist organizations counted only about 1.5% of American Jews as members, and the Zionists were a small and often mocked minority within the Jewish socialist left. We are very fortunate to have with us today the author of The Forgotten History of Jewish Anti-Zionism, historian Zachary Foster, to help us refresh and recalibrate our understandings of American Jewish anti-Zionism. Zachary Foster is a historian whose research explores the idea of Palestine as well as the origins of Palestinian identity in the 19th century. He holds an MA in Arab Studies from Georgetown University and a PhD in Near Eastern Studies from Princeton University. Zachary Foster is currently a fellow at the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights, and runs the educational and media platform Palestine Nexus, which endeavors to be a go-to source for understanding what's happening in Palestine. I'm very happy to welcome Zachary Foster to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Zach, as I mentioned in the opening, as you write, Zionism was unpopular amongst most Jews from the beginnings in the 1870s through the 1930s, including Jewish Americans and also many Orthodox Jews on theological grounds, since any action taken by humans to bring about the Messiah was deemed heretical, according to Jewish law, but also because the Zionist movement and leaders were secular and seen as trying to change the essence of Judaism itself. Can you briefly discuss religious Jewish denominations' relationship with Zionism, particularly the ones that remain anti-Zionist to this day?
Yeah, certainly. So today, the largest group of Orthodox anti-Zionist Jews are the Satmar Hasidim. The Satmar Hasidic Jews number 100,000, 110,000, perhaps more. They are spread out among the United States and in Israel and elsewhere. And they are primarily opposed to Zionism for the reason you just stated. We have a passage in the Talmud. It's actually known as the three oaths. There are these three oaths that God made to the Jews, one of which is you shall not ascend as a group up the wall being the Holy Land, the land of Israel. You shall not ascend until the Mashiach, until God decides when the Mashiach will come. And another way, and many religious authorities interpreted this to mean that although it's okay for individuals to immigrate to the land of Israel, it would be forbidden. It would be a sin for groups of Jews to move to the land of Israel, because that can only happen when the Mashiach returns to planet Earth, and the Mashiach will only return to planet Earth and bring about the second coming, bring about the end of days when God decides so. And so anything humans do to try to pull that future forward, to try to play God's role, is heretical. And so that's why the Satmar Hasidim, going all the way back to the late 19th century when Jewish Zionism first came onto the scene, that's why they were extremely hostile to it. You also have a group of Jews known as the Neturei Karta. They are probably the most famous of all the anti-Zionist religious Jews because they're so outspoken. They really take it as a core tenet of their religious belief that it is imperative upon Jews to reject Zionism and to reject the state of Israel. I think there's something else going on here, which is that many ultra-Orthodox Jews today, I might put someone like Yaakov Shapiro among them, believe that Zionism is trying to transform the nature of Judaism itself. Zionists said, you don't need to wrap tefillin, you don't need to celebrate Shabbat, you don't need to keep kosher, you don't need to do any of the things that are traditionally considered to be key aspects of Jewish faith and Jewish practice. You don't need to believe in God. I mean, most of the Zionists were atheists, of course. You don't need to embrace any Jewish principles either, like saving a life, pikuach nefesh, this idea of you would throw away all the commandments except for three just to save a life. You don't need to do that. You don't need to fix the world, refuah shlema. You don't need to take care of the sick. You don't need to do any of these Jewish things. What you need to do is move to Palestine and build a Jewish state in Palestine, where Jews have more rights than non-Jews. I mean, that's the idea of a Jewish state. Jews have privileges. Jews have special rights that non-Jews don't have. That's sort of the whole point of it being a Jewish state. And so these Orthodox Jews rejected those aspects of Zionism and of the Zionist movement. And if I could just make one final point, which is that you today have now, I think, a resurgence of even modern Orthodox Jews rejecting Zionism for very, very different reasons, not for these theological reasons owing to the three oaths and the violation of sort of the Jewish understanding of divine intervention in the world, but also because they would perceive Zionism to be a form of idol worship. And I would point to the recent works of the Orthodox, or the observant Jew, Peter Beinart, who likens Zionism to a kind of religion itself, to a kind of heresy, almost a form of idol worship. And the example he cites is that if you are a Jew and you want to be involved in Jewish communities in the United States, in Israel, in Europe, and elsewhere, but you are a self-described anti-Zionist, you reject the state of Israel as a state, as a Jewish state, you believe Israel should be a state for its citizens, let's suppose, well then, you would be excommunicated from virtually every Jewish institution in Israel, the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. You won't be allowed into the board of directors. You won't be allowed to be president or CEO or board of directors or rank and file staff. You will be effectively shunned from the organization. That's true of virtually every single major Jewish institution in the United States. In fact, I would even go so far as to say is, if you look at the board of deputies of British Jews in the UK, that's about 160 members. It's by far the most important British Jewish institution. They recently expelled two members of that institution. It's about 160 members, and two of them got expelled for co-signing an open letter criticizing Israel's actions in Gaza. Not for calling Israel's war on Gaza a genocide, not for saying Israel shouldn't be a Jewish state, but for critiquing Israel's actions in Gaza. They were expelled from the British, from the board of the of deputies of British Jews. Now, let me ask you this. What Jewish principle? How are they somehow outside of the boundaries of Judaism by criticizing Israel's actions in Gaza? Meanwhile, if you're the president of that organization and your name's Philip Rosenberg, and you told me on countless occasions that you're an atheist, well, you can be president. So criticizing Israel's actions in Gaza is less Jewish than declaring your disbelief in God. Which is sort of the foundation of Judaism, right? The declaration that there's one and only one God, the Shema Yisrael, that is sort of standing on one foot. That's Judaism. There's one God. There's a Torah. There's a Talmud. There's a Mishnah. There's halakha. There's Jewish law. There's all these Jewish principles. But where does Israel even fit in? So
right.
This is sort of the short of the short history of how Orthodox Jews and religious Jews have rejected Zionism.
Right. And even mainstream Orthodox Jews rejected it before 1967. I wonder if you can talk about some of the reasons why, briefly, American Jews were adverse to Zionism for several decades and what changed for them with the Israeli takeover of all of historic Palestine in 1967. And basically led American Jewish organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League and American Jewish Committee, to redefine their missions away from the struggle to fight anti-Semitism to defending the state of Israel or, as you write, quote, abandoning Judaism in favor of Israelism, end quote.
I think the American Jewish community was slow. They were slow to warm up to the state of Israel in the aftermath of 1948, because recall, as you pointed out in the introduction of this recording, American Jews were for the most part either non-Zionist or anti-Zionist well into the late 1930s. And the main reason was because they wanted to be considered Americans. They were trying to integrate and assimilate into American society. And they thought that if they were perceived to be associated with this foreign country, if they were perceived to be loyal to this other movement bent on building a state in some other part of the world, that would confirm the accusations, very anti-Semitic accusations that were circulating in the United States about their dual loyalties, that they weren't real Americans. They weren't even American by nationality. They were Jewish by nationality. And so these American Jews said, no, we're not. Our nationality is American. Our nationality is not Jewish. Our religion is Jewish, but our nationality is American. And that's why you had multiple Jewish institutions, American Jewish institutions. For example, in 1942, you have the American Council of Judaism. It's an organization. It's made up of a few dozen members, very prominent American Jews, wealthy, well integrated, assimilated. In 1942, at the peak of the annihilation of European Jewry, they say, we don't support a Jewish state. We support a state in Palestine where Jews and Arabs will be equal. And then many members of that organization, that institution, AJC, after 1948, they actually travel to Palestine. And many of them see the plight of the Palestinian refugees, and that reinforces their view that Jews and Arabs need to be treated equally, that there shouldn't be a Jewish state anymore, that there should be an Arab state. It should be a state for all of its citizens. And in fact, you even have the Reconstructionist movement in the United States they attack Israel for choosing symbols on the Israeli flag, the blue and white representing the Talit, the Star of David representing this Jewish symbol. They reject the Israeli flag because they believe that this is obviously going to discriminate against Israel's 20-25% of the population of the state of Israel that's not Jewish. So I think the Reconstructionist movement is critical of Israel, as is AJC and the individuals that led that. And then the same is true of AJC, the American Jewish Committee, not to be confused with the other AJC that we mentioned.
Right.
But they're also critical of the state of Israel for this reason. They don't want to be associated with the foreign movement. They're worried about accusations of dual loyalty. And so they're also basically non-Zionist until 1967.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK, based in Los Angeles. I'm Esti Chandler, very grateful to be joined today by historian and Palestine Nexus founder Zachary Foster. Palestine Nexus's next course, Jewish Anti-Zionism 101, begins on August 19th. The course will explore how and why so many Jews have been hostile toward Zionism since its origins, and will include conversations with leading Jewish anti-Zionists, including Rabbi Brant Rosen, Peter Beinart, Katie Halper, and Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. You can find out more about the course and register at palestinenexus.com. So, Zach, as Israel's treatment of Palestinians continued to deteriorate, support for Israel's endless occupation and apartheid rule into the 1980s, work by Israeli historians, sometimes referred to as the new historians, emerge. And much of their primary source material that they used came from Israeli government papers that were newly available as a result of being declassified after 30 years post the founding of the state. How did the work of new historians, including Uri Davis, Ilan Pape, Norman Finkelstein, and others, begin to shift public perception of Zionism in the 1980s and 90s?
The first thing these authors did was they shattered the foundational myths of Zionism. Benny Morris shatters the myth that the Palestinians left on their own. No, they were expelled by force, and then they weren't allowed back after they left. They were actually shot at. In fact, the Israeli army killed between 2,700 and 5,000 Palestinians in the 7 years after the 1948 war, those Palestinians trying to return to their homes. So that was really the foundational myth of the state of Israel, that, oh, the Palestinians just left on their own. That was completely shattered, not just by Benny Morris, who documents with excruciating detail every single expulsion, every single village was conquered and attacked and expelled by force. The same is true of Ilan Pape's work. You have other writers like Simha Flapan, who also shattered some of the foundational myths of the state of Israel. Some of the things he discusses, for example, how Israel held its own Jewish citizens hostile as demographic hostages, wouldn't let them leave the state of Israel, even though many of them, after the war, wanted to go back to their homes in Europe, wanted to leave the country. Israel wouldn't let them, was holding them as demographic hostages, challenging this myth that Zionism, the state of Israel, was somehow acting in the best interests of Jews, trying to ensure Jews are living their best lives. No, that is not what Zionism was about. Zionism was ensuring, was hell-bent on establishing a Jewish state in Palestine, not about preserving a Jewish dignity, not about ensuring Jewish safety or prosperity. No, 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 no. Those were secondary to the goal of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine, which required Jewish bodies in Palestine, which required sometimes holding them hostage in Palestine. Then you had the works of people like Avi Shlaim. Avi Shlaim, I think what he did was he shattered these myths associated with the perception of Israel vis-a-vis the Arab states, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, in the first few decades of the state of Israel. Basically, what he shows is that throughout those early years, in the aftermath of 48, the Syrian leaders, you had a Syrian leader by the name of Zaim, he was really trying to make a peace deal with Israel. Israel was totally uninterested in peace with Syria, because making peace with Syria required certain concessions, like allowing some refugees to return home. It was a total non-starter. Same was true after the 67 war. You have leaders in Egypt putting out feelers for peace with Israel. Israel was totally uninterested in peace with Egypt, even though that would have become, why? Because it would have required Israel to make concessions, give back land. Israel had no desire to give back the land it conquered, especially the West Bank and Gaza, which it perceived to be part of the land of Israel, historic Palestine, part of the Holy Land, had no desire to give any of that land back. So I think those are just a few of the foundational myths, but they obviously challenge the Zionist narrative, and they challenge the belief that Israel is a force for good in the world. No, Israel was expelling Palestinians, refusing to allow them to return to their homes after the war, acting very belligerently vis-a-vis its neighbors in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. And so I think these played a critical role in transforming the way Israelis, Israelis viewed the history of Zionism and the state of Israel.
Right. A two-part question here for you. What role would you say growing public awareness spurred by Israeli government and military brutality and the critical historians continuing to publish play in the Oslo process coming about in the 1990s? And did the failure of Oslo amid the eventual reality that it was merely a process with a set of rules that only Palestinians would be held accountable to, along with the settlement expansion in the West Bank, the siege of Gaza, and the subsequent repeated Israeli military assaults on Gaza, spur the continuing rise in anti-Zionism?
Yeah, there's no question that the failure of Oslo led many to start to challenge some of the underlying Zionist assumptions, right? I think the first assumption is that of Zionism is that you can have a Jewish state and you can have a democratic state. And increasingly, after the failure of Oslo, it became clear that you have millions and millions of people living under permanent, belligerent Israeli military occupation. How is that compatible with democracy when you literally have 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank, another couple hundred thousand in Jerusalem? They live under Israeli rule. Their lives are controlled by the Israeli military. They don't have freedom of movement. They don't have an Israeli passport. They can't vote in elections. They don't have control over their own lives. So how can you possibly claim Israel's a democracy when it controls millions of millions of people, denying them basic rights? And Oslo revealed that there wasn't going to be a two-state solution. The failure of Oslo revealed that there wasn't going to be a Palestinian state. Not in Camp David, when Ehud Barak offered the Palestinians Bantustans completely encircled by the Israeli military with a capital in Abu Dis, no right of return for the Palestinian refugees. They didn't get to control their borders or their airspace or their telecommunication networks or their water. So what you're talking about is that basically the realization, the waking up, that there was never going to be a Palestinian state. And as soon as you realize there's not going to be a Palestinian state besides Israel, well, then you realize that it's an apartheid state, that it's not a democracy. And that shattered the view for so many people, and I think has now was sort of the beginning of the end of Zionism. It's sort of the beginning of the waking up, the moment where people are waking up and realizing, my gosh, Zionism is not a democratic movement. It's actually an apartheid movement.
So most U.S. Jews have long identified as liberals or progressive and held values inconsistent with medieval blockades, collective punishment, the wholesale slaughter of now at least tens of thousands of innocent people with goals of ethnically cleansing, millions more. With popular mainstream liberal Zionists like the aforementioned Peter Beinart now endorsing boycott, divestment, and sanctions, as well as one by national state. And as you write, as we see on the streets in countless demonstrations, American Jewish anti-Zionism, along with popular anti-Zionism, is experiencing a steep growth in popularity and becoming a mainstream concept. Can you talk about why you now believe that it's likely a matter of years, not decades, when a majority of U.S. Jews will once again become hostile to Zionism?
I think the growth in anti-Zionism really took off about 20 years ago when it became obvious that Israel was not going to allow Palestinians to have sovereignty or an independent state. They were just going to pursue indefinite military occupation, and i.e. apartheid. And that movement was growing, and you had BDS gaining traction, more and more students at more and more universities passing BDS resolutions. And this process was unfolding. And every few years, Israel would, quote unquote, mow the lawn in Gaza, likening Palestinians to overgrown weeds, killing 100, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 every few years. And this was building, and the movement was growing. And then in 2021, in 2021, you had another war in which Israel slaughtered another 250 Palestinians. And then in 2022, you had the rise. And then in 2022, in December, you had the most right-wing government in all of Israel's history come to power. Bezalel Smotrich, a self-described fascist, a proud self-described xenophobe. You had Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's been convicted on terrorism charges and who was actually considered too radical by the Israeli military itself to serve. And so these individuals came into power. You saw more pogroms in the West Bank. You saw more violence against unarmed Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Things were getting worse and worse and worse. But then October 7th happened. And what does October 7th and obviously Israel's response to it reveal to us? Over the past 672 days, what we've been witnessing on our phones, on Instagram, on Twitter, on TikTok, on Facebook, is a live stream genocide. Right, it was an academic who once theorized that settler colonial movements inevitably lead to genocide. This was Patrick Wolf's famous argument in his topic, The Elimination of the Native. That is to say that wherever you have these settler colonial movements in Australia, in the United States, in Canada, the inevitable logic of the settler society is the elimination of the native. But now in the case of Palestine, we don't need to have an academic theorize what is the inevitable conclusion of a settler colonial movement. We can watch it on live stream every single day. 50, 100, 200, 300, 500, 700 Palestinians slaughtered every single day. In the weeks after October 7th, the death counts that OCHA, the UN organization that was putting out daily reports on the situation, if you look at those death tolls, you're talking 500, 600, 700 people being slaughtered every single day for weeks and weeks and weeks. I mean, how can you not look at that and come to the conclusion that this is a genocidal campaign? And genocide is not a crime that has statute of limitations. It doesn't go away. What we're saying is Israeli leaders will be guilty of genocide forevermore. The crime, that's not going away. And so now what you have a situation in which, you know, American Jews who are overwhelmingly liberal, progressive, opposed to medieval blockades, opposed to genocidal slaughters, opposed to the intentional starvation of millions of people, they're witnessing the country that they've been taught is their homeland carry out some of the most grotesque crimes in all of human history. And it's only getting worse. And every day you turn on the news and it's just getting worse and worse. More dead babies, more starving to death children every single day. Now we're looking at a dozen children starving to death every single day. I mean, who is going to possibly, call themselves a Zionist? Who's going to wave an Israeli flag? Who's going to consider this their homeland? So I think now we've reached a phase, the terminal phase of the genocide, where Israel has lost support among American Jews, and it's continuing to lose support among American Jews day by day by day. And if you look at the reporting among American Jews from the beginning of the genocide, going all the way back to October 2023 to today, every poll, a few more percentage points of American Jews considered a genocide. A few more percentage points of American Jews no longer identify as Zionist. And it's just going to keep moving in that direction until we reach a point, I think it'll be in the next few years, where a majority of American Jews reject Zionism altogether.
Well, we thank you so much for your time. We look forward to having you back again. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK. I've been speaking with historian and Palestine Nexus founder Zachary Foster about the history of Jewish anti-Zionism in the U.S. We need to have him back to talk about the future of it. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
It seems clear that Zionism is not delivering Jewish safety, as was the promise. and continues to be the claim of Zionist institutions. The existence of the self-proclaimed Jewish state, carrying out continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and an ongoing worsening genocide, is not creating safety for Jews anywhere and is actually likely to be making Jews less safe. As we've tragically seen in the last several months with two violent attacks on pro-Israel events organized by American Jewish groups, where perpetrators shouted "Free Palestine" as they acted. And as Leslie Williams wrote last month at Truthout in an op-ed titled "Jewish Safety Will Not Come Through More Guns, Policing, and Repression," the likes of which we've also seen in response to over a year of nonviolent student protests on American campuses. Those protests, like the violent anti-Israel attacks, have all been roundly condemned as anti-Semitic by politicians and pro-Zionist groups and organizations, even though both the attackers and all of the nonviolent student protests were vocal about being opposed to Zionists and Zionism and protesting the state of Israel's actions in Gaza rather than hatred towards Jewish people. For the second part of our extended conversation today, I am very pleased to have Leslie Williams back with us to talk about her recent op-ed, "Jewish Safety Will Not Come Through More Guns, Policing, and Repression," and to discuss what can and does create safety for all minorities and oppressed communities. Leslie Williams organizes around anti-racism, Islamophobia, and Palestine with Jewish Voice for Peace, the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, and Global Jews for Justice in Palestine. She has spoken on Palestinian rights, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism at gatherings of American Studies Association, Democratic Socialists of America, and American Muslims for Palestine, Friends of Sabeel North America, Jewish Voice for Peace, and many others. She has published multiple op-eds pertinent to our conversation today, including "The Anti-Defamation League Kills the Black Jewish Alliance," "We Cannot Fight Anti-Semitism and Anti-Black Racism in Isolation," and, of course, her most recent piece, "Jewish Safety Will Not Come Through More Guns, Policing, and Repression." Leslie is also a consultant and speaker for the Parseo Antisemitism from a Framework of Collective Liberation Curriculum. It is always my great pleasure to welcome Leslie Williams back to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much, Esty. Delighted to be here.
Well, to continue on, you know, in this discussion of ultimately about Jewish safety when what doesn't actually provide it. As you wrote in your piece, the attacks which killed two young Israeli embassy staffers at Washington, D.C. and severely burned participants in a Run for Their Lives event in Boulder, Colorado, in support of Israeli hostages, have been roundly condemned as anti-Semitic by politicians and Zionist groups, even though both attackers were vocal about targeting Zionists and seemingly motivated by anger at Israel's massively deadly actions in Gaza rather than hatred towards Jews, as the campus protests have also been wrongly characterized. Mm-hmm. Thusly, in both cases, the attacks and protests have led to calls for increased surveillance and security on campuses and around Jewish institutions. You begin your essay by posing two questions. Does increased surveillance, policing, and more severe crackdowns on protests actually make Jews safer? And, or is it actually exacerbating that problem? And I would like to start our conversation by asking you those same two questions.
Sure. So I think there are two things that we need to look at. There's the cause of these horrible actions that you mentioned, and then there's the approach of the solutions. So, you know, as you were saying in your intro, these have been described as anti-Semitic, but I would not deny completely that there's an aspect of anti-Semitism, but it is clear, as you said, that these are primarily reactions against Zionism and against Israel. And I think a valid question for people concerned about Jewish safety is, if you have all the mainstream American Jewish organizations saying that there is no daylight between Israel and between the Jewish people, that Israel is the Jewish people and the Jewish people equals Israel, as Jonathan Greenblatt of the ADL has been saying over and over again, that anti-Zionism is the same as anti-Semitism, there are going to be people who get upset about what's happening in Gaza who will take them at their word and assume, yes, all Jews are doing this. All Jews are responsible for this. So that's not to justify the horrible violence that we've seen, but you can't really have it both ways. You can't claim that Israel and the Jewish people are the same and then claim that it's anti-Semitism if people do in fact decide that attacking Jews or painting Free Palestine on a synagogue, for example, is anti-Semitic, when it's clearly really a reaction to what's going on in Gaza and an expression of anti-Zionism. So that's the first thing. But then in terms of what is the solution? What do we do about this? How do we protect people? So first of all, when you hear organizations like the heads of Jewish organizations or the ADL talking about the need to protect Jews, they have a somewhat limited idea of what it means by protecting Jews. And all of their safety and surveillance programs are really aimed at protecting, let's be honest, white Jews, white, straight, able-bodied Jews, because so many of their solutions are based on working with the police, based on working with organizations like the FBI or Homeland Security. And that's ignoring the way that all of these organizations and all these institutions have historically and continue to be dangerous for Jews of color, African-American Jews, Latino, Latinx Jews, Jews who are in the LGBTQ community. And so as Bentley Addison, who is a well-known Black Jewish writer, says, "I'm already terrified every time I walk into a shul because of fear of an anti-Semitic attack. I don't also need to be terrified of the possibility of police violence." So when we're talking about protection for Jews, are we really talking about protection for all Jews, or are we really just talking about protection for white Jews? The other thing, though, is that we need to have all marginalized people, gay people, Black people, immigrants, Jews, in solidarity together. And the increasing focus on just targeting anti-Semitism, first of all, a lot of people in those other communities feel, why is it that there are no such calls for protection and security for our groups? Why aren't we talking about a national anti-racism program, a national anti-homophobia program, a national anti-sexism program? Why is it that we are isolating this one form of discrimination as though it's so much more important than all the others, that the rest of us don't matter? And that means that it is more difficult to get other marginalized people to join in solidarity, to stand up for Jews, to stand up against anti-Semitism. And then even if you're just talking about what is best for white middle-class Jews, historically, working with organizations of surveillance, organizations on the right, organizations that are involved with policing, have not always really worked out for even white Jews. So, you know, many, many progressive white Jews have said, this is not going to be helping us. It's not just a matter of it's building resentment, but we know that the police in the United States are heavily aligned with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the Klan. Many of them are very right-wing and very aligned with MAGA. Many of them are violently anti-immigrant, anti-African-American, and also anti-Semitic. So you are putting your safety in the hands of people who do not have your best interest at heart.
Very well said. You know, Zionists have long argued that there's actually the anti-Semitism problem is on the left, and they've tried endlessly to sell what they used to call the new anti-Semitism,
right,
which is, as we've been discussing, that anti-Zionism is inherently anti-Semitic. But you point out in your piece that their arguments have now morphed into the claim that progressivism itself, not just pro-Palestine activism, is inherently dangerous to Jews. And we've seen people like the aforementioned Jonathan Greenblatt, who being quite openly racist in his remarks, and yet getting no pushback from it about for it from mainstream audiences. Do you like talk to me about Jonathan Greenblatt and his ilk having joined the people you were just discussing, the white Christian nationalism movement, and really giving up any, you know, claim to be in support of Jewish safety, in support for continued Israeli apartheid, genocide, and expanded Greater Israel.
Right. So I'm not going to try and get into Jonathan Greenblatt's head or heart. I believe that it is possible that he truly believes that what he's doing is the best way to address Jewish safety, but that doesn't mean that he's right, and that doesn't mean that we have to listen to him. First of all, a lot of people in the ADL don't even agree with him, and the ADL has been losing lots and lots of their staff members. They've lost pretty much their entire civil rights legal department. So this organization that calls itself the oldest and most powerful civil rights organization no longer really has a civil rights legal department. I think that should tell you something about the direction they're going. And as you mentioned, I think in June, he spoke to a group of Republican state's attorneys, and he said that the real threats to Jews were the radical left, the same people who were in Occupy Wall Street, who were in the Defund the Police movement, and in Black Lives Matter. So he's pretty much said that anybody in those groups are on the wrong side, that they are endangering Jews, which is, of course, ludicrous. But then what's really curious about it is he has so clearly, as in that speech, you know, he's aligning himself with MAGA. He supported Elon Musk when Elon Musk did his little awkward hand gesture. Jonathan Greenblatt was saying, well, you know, it was just it was an emotional moment. It didn't really mean that he was a Nazi. And even other people in the ADL were saying, you've got to be kidding, right? And, you know, he just did a very long interview in the New York Times yesterday, which I'd really encourage people to look at. And the interviewer asked him about this, you know, how is it that you are making common cause with these people that used to criticize? So he's working with Sebastian Gorka, for example. And a few years ago, he had said that Gorka was linked to openly racist anti-Semitic hate groups, but now he's working with them. He talked about Trump in 2016 and 17. Greenblatt was a strong, strong critic of Trump, and he blamed him for Charlottesville and the Nazi rally. And he talked about his penchant for slandering minorities. He was the first head of a Jewish organization to call for removing a president from office. And now he is working hand in glove with Trump over the persecutions of people like Mahmoud Khalil and all of the other Palestinian students and Palestinian supporters. And in fact, the ADL, even though they always, even before October 7th, much more of the ADL's resources and their webpage was devoted to Israel advocacy as opposed to civil rights. But they have removed almost everything from their website now that is about anything other than Israel. So this is a clear, clear change in their strategy. But, you know, the question is, what does this mean exactly, and why is he doing this? I think it is partly wanting to be more allied to power and holding on to power and feeling that that is somehow the best way to support the Jewish community. But as we've said, what they're doing is they're abandoning allies. They're even losing allies within the mainstream Jewish community. And certainly they're losing a lot of support among younger Jews and progressive Jews. So I think this is very misguided on their part. And I don't think it is doing anything to really improve on the question of anti-Semitism.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK here in Los Angeles. I'm Esty Chandler, very happy to be joined once again today by my friend and fellow Jewish Voice for Peace organizer, Leslie Williams, about her most recent Truth Out op-ed, Jewish Safety Will Not Come Through More Guns, Policing, and Repression, and discussing what can and does create safety for all minorities and oppressed communities. So we've established that the, you know, Trump's cabinet is filled with white nationalists.
Yes.
And as you write, the White House Faith Office and Anti-Christian Bias Task Force are part of the implementation of Project 2025's radical blueprint for installing Christian nationalist governance throughout the federal government. VP J.D. Vance, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and House Speaker Mike Johnson all maintain connections to that movement, forming what the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism has called a triangle of influence. Can you briefly talk about how the argument of left-wing anti-Semitism being the problem for Jewish safety just gives cover to Trump and Vance and Hegseth and others for their anti-Semitism and racism, ultimately facilitating more attacks on people of color and the left more broadly?
Yeah. So just to dispense once and all for all with the left anti-Semitism, any organization is going to have people, individuals who have anti-Semitic or racist or homophobic attitudes, who may say things that are racist, anti-Semitic, etc. But right-wing ideology has that baked into it. I mean, what is fundamental about nationalism is these are our people, these are the people that belong, and there are outsiders that don't belong. So to a certain extent, racism, anti-Semitism, these are all really sort of baked into right-wing ideology. They're a feature, not a bug. And that's very different from the left. The other thing is, if you just look at surveys, in 2022, there was a really wonderful survey that I would encourage people to look at from Tufts University, Anti-Semitic Attitudes Across the Ideological Spectrum. And it states very plainly that while anti-Semitism is often thought about through a both sides lens, our evidence suggests that the problem of anti-Semitism is much more serious on the right than the left. The evidence confirms that the anti-Semitism that has been on prominent display in white nationalist protests is not confined to a tiny group of extremists. It is quite common among young conservatives, much more so than among older conservatives or among liberals of any age. So again, it is clear that anti-Semitism on the right is far more serious. So why do people like Greenblatt keep talking about anti-Semitism on the left? Well, if you look at what they say, pretty much everything they say about anti-Semitism on the left is about Palestine. So a recent, Greenblatt is always talking about how many anti-Semitic incidents there have been. So, you know, he said there have been 3,000 anti-Semitic incidents in the 3 months after October 7th. But in January 2024, the ADL conceded that the increase was derived from a change in methodology in which they were counting anti-Zionist chants and slogans, and that those anti-Zionist slogans were 40% of the total incidents. So 40% of this supposed increase in anti-Semitism is really just anti-Palestinianism. So that's one thing that, Greenblatt and his ilk are really just using this canard of left-wing anti-Semitism to silence Palestinians. But also, if you say that anti-Semitism on the left is the most important, that gives you an excuse to not focus on the actual anti-Semites on the right. So again, working with Gorka, working with Trump, you can say, well, we don't need to worry about them because we really need to focus on anti-Semitism on the left. So for example, there's a great video of Republican Nancy Mace, who's a strong supporter of Israel, and she's talking with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, and she says, I love Jews, I love Israel, even self-hating Jews like you. So straight up anti-Semitic comment from a MAGA supporter, from an Israel supporter, but we don't have to pay attention to that because we need to be afraid of Mahmoud Khalil and his keffiyeh.
And Medea Benjamin.
Yes, and Medea Benjamin, yes.
So as you write, a better route to Jewish community safety lies in building solidarity with all marginalized groups, people of color, Muslims, immigrants, LGBTQ folks, and those with disabilities. Can you talk about the historical precedents for the success of this type of approach?
Yeah. And I think it's important to know that this has been going on for a long time. So, for example, there was an organization called Jews for Urban Justice. It started in the early 1970s, and they were working on anti-Semitism, but they also fought anti-Black racism. They fought the war in Vietnam. They put out a manifesto on the oppression and liberation of the Jewish people in America in 1970, but it talked about the importance of groups working together, of supporting anti-racism, anti-war, anti-poverty. It called for white Jewish solidarity with Black people, with Native Americans, with Mexican Americans, Italian Americans, and Appalachians. And it was also critical of US policy in Palestine. Going back a little bit further in Europe, the Bund, which was another early pro-socialist group, was really focusing a lot on class issues. And so it was standing up for poor people and working class people of all these different ethnicities. And the Bund has seen a resurgence. And there's a Bund in the United States, and there are Bund organizations across Europe that are, again, taking on Palestine, but also taking on anti-Semitism, racism, and other attacks on marginalized people. In the 1980s, there was a movement in Portland to address racism, homophobia, and anti-Semitism when there was an increase in skinhead activity that was attacking all of these different groups. So all of these are saying we can't fight these in isolation. We have to realize that all of these forms of oppression and hatred are connected, and that the best way to address them is to work together.
Of course, topics you've been writing about for as long as I've known you.
Yes.
As I mentioned in the opening, you are also a consultant and speaker for the Parseo Anti-Semitism from a Framework of Collective Liberation curriculum. Can you tell us more about that curriculum and that approach to collective safety?
Yeah, so it's a lot of these same ideas that we can't address this in isolation, but that also when we look at anti-Semitism, a lot of the anti-Semitism training, right now the ADL is doing anti-Semitism training, required anti-Semitism training for colleges. You can't register at Northwestern University this quarter unless you've taken the ADL's anti-Semitism training. But anyway, a lot of it, first of all, it not only just focuses on Jews, they pretty much focus on European Jews. Whereas the Parseo curriculum does also look at the histories of Sephardic and Mizrakim communities and other Jewish communities throughout the world. So it's not just focusing it on European anti-Semitism. It also looks at concurrent forms of racism that were happening at the times of the greatest surges in anti-Semitism. So for example, looking at the Crusades, not just what was happening at Jews, but what was happening to Muslims as well. And looking at the Jim Crow era in the United States and how there was a rise in anti-Semitism at the same time that there was this rise in anti-Black hatred. Looking at World War II, the anti-Semitism that prevented many Jews from being allowed to immigrate at the same time that we saw this rise in anti-Japanese sentiment. So it's not just saying that we need to work together and build in solidarity, but looking at how these histories really intertwine and intersect, and that so often the same sort of organizations and the same institutions that have been oppressing Jews have been oppressing these other groups. And I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, Parseo, we offer an alternative anti-Semitism curriculum. And in fact, I was very excited to present the Parseo anti-Semitism curriculum to Northwestern students who were boycotting the JUF and ADL-based curriculum. And we're really happy to do that for anybody else that does not want to have to take that curriculum. But there are other organizations like the Community Safety Campaign, which started in Kavod in Boston, which is a Jewish congregation with a lot of younger progressive Jews and with a Jews of Color caucus. And they're doing community solidarity where they bring in non-Jewish volunteers to act as de-escalators and support during services, but they're not bringing in the police. They work with Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a white organization that has long been in solidarity with poor people, Black people, Indigenous people. So it's working with all of these different marginalized groups to provide community safety and de-escalation, as opposed to relying on the police, the military, ICE, et cetera.
And it makes sense when you start to think about it that way, that this attack on liberal educational institutions,
yes,
and history itself is,
yes,
we don't want you to see how these different,
right,
we don't want you to know about the history,
right,
of Black Americans and slavery,
mm-hmm,
and we don't want you to see how these things intersect.
Sure.
Because, you know, if they can make it all about anti-Semitism, later on they can blame everything on the Jews.
Well, also, you know, there was an interesting quote that I saw from someone in the Kavod community saying that one of the things that's so terrifying about anti-Semitism, and, you know, this is a community that you grew up in a way that I didn't grow up in because I'm a convert, but the sense that throughout history, nobody was supporting you. You'll hear people say over and over again, nobody cares about the Jews. People only care about dead Jews. You know, nobody supported us in Germany. Nobody supported us during the Middle Ages. Nobody supported us during the Crusades. And the just the wonderful sense of solidarity, but just safety and relief at seeing white people from Surge and seeing Black organizations and seeing Latino organizations all working together and saying, yes, we do think anti-Semitism is important. We do want to protect Jews. And just in terms of just the psychological and emotional freedom and support that that can give to Jewish communities to not always be seeing ourselves as completely isolated, to break this notion that everyone in the world hates us, everyone will always hate us. You know, that's another thing with Parseo is we look at anti-Semitism as being cyclical, but not necessarily as eternalist. You know, we often hear that anti-Semitism is the oldest hatred, it's different from all other forms of hatred, and so we have to just fight it on our own because nobody else is with us. And that's really a sad and scary way to go through life, and it's not something that I think we want to pass on to the next generation of American Jews. And by embracing things like the Community Safety Campaign and anti-Semitism through collective liberation, I think maybe we can break that pattern.
Right, and not emulate Israel, which was built upon that exact concept, and we can all see how that's working out.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
I can't thank you enough for your fantastic writing, for taking time out of your weekend to join us once again today. I learned so much talking to you. I know that our listeners learned so much from reading your articles and from our conversations. And likewise, I'm sure we will be having you back again soon.
I hope so. I hope so. Thanks so much, Jesty. This was wonderful.
Thank you, Leslie. I'll close with a few words from Rabbi Brant Rosen in response to being asked the question, if the state of Israel doesn't make Jewish people safer, what does? His response, safety and security through solidarity. I think historically you could make a strong argument that over-militarism only endangers everybody in the end. And Israel is one of the most militarized countries in the world. We should make no mistake about that. Does that make Jews or anyone else safe in the long run? I would say no. End quote. Once again, I want to thank our guests, historian and Palestine Nexus founder Zachary Foster, Palestine Nexus's upcoming online course, Jewish Anti-Zionism 101, begins on August 19th. You can find out more information and register for the course at palestinenexus.com/courses. And writer, organizer, and anti-racism, Islamophobia, and Palestine solidarity activist, Leslie Williams. Her most recent Truth Out op-ed is Jewish Safety Will Not Come Through More Guns, Policing, and Repression. I also want to thank the wonderful Ozzy Flamenco for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler thanking you for your continued support of the fiercely independent KPFK and for taking this hour to put the Middle East in focus.
Assumpta Oturu, aka Sister Africa, host of Spotlight Africa on KPFK for over 4 decades. Transitioned on July 2, 2025, here in Los Angeles. Assumpta was a long-standing member of the African Studies Association and a vital force in the Africanist, scholarly, and media communities. A celebration of her life. achievements, and relentless struggle for peace and justice will be held at the Episcopal Church of the Advent, Sunday, August 10th, from 4 to 7 p.m. The church is located at 2614 South Longwood Avenue, La Brea and Adams in Los Angeles. This event is hosted by Radio Aphrodisia and KPFK and Friends of Assumpta. All are welcome to attend. Further information is available by calling Moza at 323-320-3810. That's 323-320-3810 or at our website, kpfk.org.
Yo, this is Immortal Technique. Right now, you're listening to KPFK.